I think HIV remains concerning in that there's still no cure. Once a person becomes infected, they remain so for life.
That's Jason Farley. He's an adjunct associate professor in the Faculty of Health at UTS with expertise in the epidemiology of HIV and AIDS.
I think the youth of today in particular have see HIV as a disease that has, evolved so much, and it's no different than diabetes or high blood pressure or the like. And therefore, people don't may not take it as seriously as we did in the early 80s and 90s. And, if you talk to persons who are living with HIV, they will say if they had their choice, they would not get the disease. So I really think it's important that we take a step back, really think about how we can prevent HIV infection while still living a very healthy, sexually robust life that prevents us from acquiring HIV and potentially other STIs as well.
The face of HIV and AIDS has changed massively since the 1980s. A huge part of this is due to the fact that innovations in treatment can help drastically reduce the rate of HIV becoming AIDS, as well as transmitting the virus to someone else.
Particularly people who did not live through those earlier days don't see HIV as a death sentence at all, and that's great. It helps to reduce our stigma. It helps for patients to be accepted, and it really does change the tone of HIV. In regards to what we can do today for prevention, if a person has been exposed, they can seek post-exposure prophylaxis, and there are recommended regimens for that use HIV treatment medications called antiretrovirals. They can use those for prevention of infection, generally within 48 to 72 hours, and generally no longer than that. Some clinicians will allow it to go slightly longer. Others have a very strict 48-hour period where they will, after exposure, give medication to prevent HIV infection.
The latest innovation in HIV treatment is something called pre-exposure prophylaxis, otherwise known as PrEP, which a HIV-negative person can take to reduce their chance of contracting the virus.
Basically, PrEP is a medication called, at this point, Truvada. It is a two combination pill in which you would take prior to any sexual encounter, men or women. And this medication needs to get into your systems basically at the right tissue, right point, making sure it's there before sex. And then after that is there and at appropriate levels, it has been shown for people who are really adherent to be up to 99% effective at preventing HIV infection. That's really important and really cool, but it also provides us with this opportunity to sit back and say, wow, how do we, as sexually active individuals, and for example, myself as a gay man, how do I now look at sex with PrEP? Because so much of sexual decision making was made utilizing an HIV paradigm, utilizing saying, well, this is the biggest thing I have to worry about and the risk that I'm concerned about, and therefore you change your sexual practices and change your behaviors. And now people with PrEP can re-engage in a sexual decision-making process that is less about fear and more about pleasure.
Although PrEP may drastically diminish the chance of contracting the HIV virus, Jason makes one important note. Being on PrEP doesn't make you exempt from other sexually transmitted diseases or infections.
So our biggest concerns, particularly among young gay men, and when I say young, that's generally in the range of 13 to 24, in the States at least, that's what we're talking about when we say young. The STI incidence, so number of new cases among young MSM, regardless of PrEP, has been on the rise for years. And what many gay men don't realize is that unlike HIV, which doesn't transmit very well orally, syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea transmits very easily through oral sex. So we screen as part of a PrEP program the oral pharynx or the back of the throat. We screen the urine, which will give us obviously what's happening in the penis. We screen if you're a female, obviously vaginal screening. And then we also do rectal screening in anyone who participates in anal intercourse, both men or women, for chlamydia and gonorrhea. And then we draw blood for syphilis. And what we're seeing in our PrEP patients is, and data now from San Francisco has shown, and kind of what is similar to my practice as a nurse practitioner, that we are seeing increasing STIs, but we're also looking in more places for STIs. So before we would come in and bring a patient into the clinic and we would ask for a urine or do a swab of the urethra, and that would be it. But now with PrEP, because we know better, we do better. And as a result, we now screen three body sites in men, and we're finding more STIs.
In Australia, PEP is currently administered under the Therapeutic Goods Administration. However, pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, isn't. Currently, PrEP is only available on a trial basis to a very few selective people. The Australian government recently announced that 3,700 high-risk, mostly gay and bisexual men, would be enrolled in the expanded PrEP Implementation in Communities trial. However, with PrEP previously being trialled on only 300 people, widespread accessibility is a continuing issue.
Accessibility for PrEP is highly varied. If you're well insured or have medical aid of some sort, PrEP is generally not about having problems accessing your pill. The pill in the United States is the easiest part to access through either assistance programs from the manufacturer, from the drug company itself, or through co-pays that you need to pay through your insurance, which are generally small. The pill is the easiest thing. We can get you that pretty simply. Outside the pill, though, the PrEP, in order to participate effectively in a prevention program, you need to have HIV and STI screenings every 90 days. With my PrEP patients, I bring them in, we do the counseling, we do the initial HIV testing, and then we do the initial STI screenings for all the necessary STIs. And then we talk about sexual health and sexual risk reduction and all those things that make someone, you know, sexually healthy in a very sex positive way. After that, I schedule them their next appointment in 90 days. And then that process continues every 90 days, checking in on their HIV status, their STI status, and the like. Now, those visits, if you're not insured, can be quite costly. Now, if you're coming through something like a National Health Service, those visits would be much cheaper as long as the service covers those prevention activities. If they do not, we would not, in most clinics, have an opportunity to have that free. Some of the public health clinics are presently looking at sliding scale fee models, which means you pay based on your income. But in private clinics and private settings, that's not available, and you would pay, depending on what your insurance requirements are, you would pay a pretty substantial fee for the wraparound services in addition to getting the pill.
Jason Farley from the Faculty of Health at UTS. Access to PrEP in the Western world is one thing, but HIV and AIDS is a global issue. Liz Croc is from the Australian New Zealand Association of Nurses in AIDS Care.
It varies from country to country, but, you know, New Guinea on our doorstep, the epidemic's quite large and there's a lot of sexual violence in some countries. So, you know, it could be women that may require PrEP more so than gay men in some countries. So it depends on the demographic of the epidemic in each country, which varies really widely. You know, in some countries could be injecting drug users who don't have access to clean needles, like, say, in Russia and Ukraine, places like that, you know, and PrEP hasn't been tested properly in injecting drug users at all in that population. So until the research is done, medical practitioners are always very reluctant to prescribe a drug.
However, for those affected by the virus in the developing world, having access to sufficient health services, let alone HIV treatments, is the next problem to solve.
It's often around, you know, building capacity in those countries, strengthening the health systems themselves is key, and HIV has actually been quite a catalyst for that in a lot of countries, you know, because people have gone in there and HIV workers have been real activists, and that includes nurses, doctors, and community development workers have been really proactive and very highly political. They've actually managed to, you know, integrate HIV treatments into other services, such as, for example, general sexual health services or maternal and child health services.